We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In 1922, 20 non-union workers were tortured and killed in a mine riot in southern Illinois. It came to be known as the Heron Massacre, and at the time was big news across the country. Our guest, John Griswold, grew up in Heron, and he says that he had long wondered how the people of a region that he knew so well could have been involved in violence on that scale, and he turned to writing for help in trying to answer that question. And this morning, we'll be talking about the novel that resulted. The title is A Democracy of Ghosts, and it is published by Wordcraft of Oregon. So if you're interested, you can seek it out. He'll be actually doing an appearance and a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore, and I believe that is today, right? 4:30 this afternoon at the Author's Corner. So if you're interested, that's on the UI campus. You're interested, you certainly should stop by, and that way you could hear from him and talk to him and buy a copy of the book if you like. This morning here on the program, also, we'll be talking about the story, the background, a little bit about writing with him, and of course, questions are welcome too. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest, John Griswold, is a lecturer of English here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He teaches undergraduate creative writing, both fiction and nonfiction, and he's here in the studio with us, and we're glad to have him here. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David,
for being here.
People are always telling me I have a face for radio, so I'm delighted to be here.
Me too. Heron is located in Williamson County in southern Illinois, and this is a place that is known for a number of violent incidents that occurred in a period roughly from the 1870s into the 20s, and the Heron Massacre was one of them. And as a result of these things, it has come to be called Bloody Williamson. Tell us about Heron and about Williamson County. Set the stage for us.
Heron's a town of about 12,000, and it's in the third county north of the confluence of the rivers, Ohio and Mississippi. Massive coal fields down there, soft bituminous coal. There have been several historical periods of unrest in the area, starting with what they called the Bloody Vendetta, which started in 1868 over a brawl over cards. And families joined in on the various sides, and that didn't actually end until 1876. So the media had styled this as the Bloody Vendetta, and this is where that epithet, bloody, I think, comes from. Then there was the Heron Massacre of 1922, and I can explain more about that. Even after the massacre happened, there was something that is usually referred to as the Klan War. It was actually a wet-dry war. A kind of cultural war over enforcement of the Volstead Act and whether there should be liquor or not. After that was resolved and the Klan had more or less depleted all their resources in trying to fight liquor in the area, then it was left to what I call the hooligans, mostly a sort of infamous gangster named Charlie Berger and the Shelton brothers, Carl, Big Earl, and Bernie Shelton. And that lasted up until about 1928. And Berger was hanged, often said to be the last man hanged in Illinois. And then, of course, Prohibition was repealed in 1933. And so that was sort of the end of the big violence in the area.
Growing up there, did you have the sense that this place had that kind of legacy, or did you think of it as being particularly that much different from any other place that you could have grown up?
I didn't see it in that way. It was a kind of idyllic childhood in a place of great natural beauty, and I knew the warmth of the people and my relatives and everyone. Much of the coal mining took place underground or even in the strip mines. All of that was reclaimed by the earth. And so the violence was sort of a fashion like that. You knew it was there, but you didn't really take note of it, or at least I didn't until I was at least in my late teens.
The event here now, this would be something that it would surprise me if very many people listening to us would have heard of the Heron Massacre. But at the time, this was huge news, and it was something that got wide attention in the mass media of the time, was widely condemned, I think, all the way up to the White House.
It was, yeah. Harding called a cabinet meeting on it.
Just give us the sort of we can talk about it in greater detail. And then, of course, we want to get in and talk about the book and the way that you tell the story. But give us the bare bones of it, just so people will know something about what it is we're talking about.
Sure. The short version is that in June of 1922, an absentee mine owner out of Cleveland, his name was William J. Lester, shipped coal from a small strip mine that was southeast of Heron, actually not in Heron. He did this during a national coal strike and in violation of an agreement that he'd made with the local UMWA, who were willing to let him strip the overburden of dirt off of the coal seam, but not to load or ship the coal. This was nothing illegal. It was just ill-advised. And in fact, his peers in the industry and the National Guard commander and just about everyone told him not to try to do this. Thousands, by some accounts, of union supporters from all over the region, certainly not just from Heron and probably not just from southern Illinois, surrounded the mine and its 50 non-union men. Hundreds, probably thousands of shots were exchanged between the two sides. On the morning of the second day, the non-union men surrendered. They believed that they were doing that to be shipped out of the county, that they would be given safe passage back to where they were from. Most were from the Chicago area. Instead, they were led on a death march that ended in Heron, perhaps a bit coincidentally because the railway station was there. Their fates varied, but the march led to humiliation, torture, and murder, as you said, and some were shot, hanged, or beaten to death. Some had their throats cut or they were urinated on as they lay dying. And it was a kind of equal opportunity mob, which I think the media picked up on as well and reacted to. The mob was white and black and of native southern Appalachian stock and also immigrant ethnic. And even women and children participated in some of it, which I think certainly caused some of the reaction. The corpses of the men were subsequently displayed publicly in a kind of makeshift morgue that had been set up in an empty department store in Heron. And people from all over the region came to view the bodies, and they cussed the corpses and shouted at them and spit on them and so on. And as you said, 20 non-union men died. Also, three union miners who were some of the first to die in the event. And within a day, the country kind of went into a frenzy against the region. So the national media picked up on it. Chambers of commerce all across the country. Politicians declared their outrage. Black Jack Pershing begged to march on southern Illinois, and Williamson County itself was being called the black spot of the nation, anti-American, that they were Reds and Bolsheviki, and so on. In the end, there was a coroner's jury, a grand jury, two criminal trials, and Illinois House of Representatives investigation. And despite there being 262 indictments in the criminal trials, not a single person was found guilty of any crime. When justice wasn't done, of course, the media seized on that miscarriage as well. And Heron was called, variously, an unconquered province of lawlessness and a stench in the nostrils of humanity. Mm-hmm. And this kind of anger went on for decades.
And you could understand perhaps why, at least here, that it might have happened here, because actually at the time that Heron was a hotbed of union activism. I think it was one point someone said it was the most radical town in America, something like that.
It was. The town was probably 100% union, and not just the miners, but related trades and certainly the merchants and everyone who depended on the miners for their livelihood. Illinois, you know, during this period was a sort of a radical state. Many of the organizers for the union came from Illinois. You know, mining has always been a dangerous job, a hard job, no benefits and low pay in the early days, and especially, you know, in the days before mechanization with hand digging and hand loading and all of that. I saw somewhere an astounding 42,000 people died in the United States digging coal from 1884 to 1912. And so the union came along, the UMWA came along just at the time that coal was discovered in Heron. And there's no doubt that they had a lot on the line.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Griswold. He teaches creative writing here at the University of Illinois, and he is the author of a recently published novel that we're talking here about, and a novel that is the that is based on, takes off from, the event that he just detailed, the Heron Massacre. His novel is A Democracy of Ghosts, and it's published by Wordcraft of Oregon. Questions welcome. People want to be a part of the conversation here at some point. You can call us 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you have a natural family connection to all of this because your grandfather, a man named William Sneed, was the district president for the United Mine Workers. He also happened to be a member of the Illinois Senate and is the basis for one of the characters in Democracy of Ghosts, whose name is William Sneed. Was this something that, and I know that you never knew your grandfather. He died before you were born, or maybe it was when you were too young to know him. So the only way that you would have known him was from what anybody, your mom or anybody else, would have said about him. Was this something that was discussed in your family?
The massacre was almost never discussed. My mom, you know, my mom was older. She and my dad were both of the World War II generation, so almost old enough to be my grandparents themselves. And her father, William J. Sneed, had died in 1949, so he was dead almost 15 years before I was born. My mom lionized my grandfather, loved him dearly, called him Daddy to the end of her long life, and he evidently called her Baby. You know, she portrayed him as a caring and effectual leader, possibly had some political genius, took care of his constituency in every way possible during the Depression, fed people from his back door, and did his best to make sure that monies were allocated for projects that his community could work on and so on. And so later, as I started to understand the region's history a bit better, I was having a hard time reconciling not just this place and the people who lived there, and how this event could have happened there, but also, of course, my own grandfather's role. As it turns out, he did play some kind of a role. I don't know how significant we can say it is. Just before the massacre happened, he sent an email. A telegram to labor leader John Lewis, asking if the non-union men working at the Lester Mine had permission from the AFL to actually be there and to be working. Lewis famously replied that they were not affiliated with a union and to treat them as you would any other common strikebreakers. Both telegrams were printed side by side in the local papers, and the massacre happened within a day or two after that. Yeah. So, yeah, I was always trying to reconcile, you know, this man who was portrayed by my mom as a kind of FDR figure on a smaller scale or something with the events that happened there.
Yeah. As a writer, if you create a character, I'm sure that you would feel free to do whatever with them or make of them whatever you will. And here, not only is this character in part your creation because you're having to imagine a good deal about him and his life and his motivation, but this is in some respect, your grandfather. Did you feel constrained by the fact that, first of all, this was a real person, and second, this was a relative of yours?
I don't know if constrained is the right word, but concerned, certainly. You know, in some early draft of the book, I actually called the town Buckhorn, which was a nickname for the town, instead of calling it Heron. One thing that interests me about the event is that there is a kind of silence surrounding the event, and it's gone on much longer than any national attention might have been focused on the region. There's a hesitancy to talk about that that has a downside. You know, I assume there might be tourism dollars to be made off of some of this, or interest, historical interest in other ways. And certainly Chicago has made peace with, you know, what people have called the Bang Bang Capone era. So there are themed restaurants and bus tours and that sort of a thing. You know, Heron and Southern Illinois in general has not come to terms with it in the same way. At some point in the writing of the novel and the revision of the various drafts, I decided the town needed to be called Heron. You know, if you were writing a labor era, gangster era novel about Chicago, you wouldn't call it Lake City. At least I wouldn't call it Lake City. Mm-hmm. You would call it Chicago. Mm-hmm. So once I headed down that road, I decided that several of the key real-life actors in the event probably needed to be called by their real name as well. And certainly if I'm going to do that, then I'm going to go ahead and do that for a relative of mine.
Yeah, I think that's it's an interesting choice, I guess, and something that I did want to ask you about because, as you say, I suppose you, if you wanted to write a gangster story set in Chicago, you could if you wanted to. You could say it was set in Lake City, and you could make up names, and you could do whatever you like with it. And you, I'm sure, could have, if you you could have written this novel, but you could have changed the names to protect the innocent or the guilty, and you could have said it, you could have at least changed the name of the town, and maybe then only people who really knew some of the backstory would recognize where it was and what you were talking about. And you probably could have accomplished the same thing.
Possibly so. There is a, it's strange about historical fiction. I never had ambitions to write historical fiction, and I may never do so again. You know, there's a kind of after echo of the real events that comes in when you're reading the fiction. And people often like to say, you know, this is based on a real story or based on actual events. And I think oftentimes readers connect with it in ways that they wouldn't. You know, if it can be shown to be that. For my Southern Illinois audience, I did consider all of this, and in the end, I made the choice to go ahead and call it by its real name, the town, and to use certain people's names. And that after echo was important to me.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit more about the character, about William Sneed.
William Sneed in the book has characteristics of the real man as I understand him to be. He was from Franklin County, which was the next county north. In real life, he grew up in a place called the Diggins, which was called that not because of coal, but because traditional medicine herbs and roots were found there, probably going back to Native American days, and so it was called the Diggins. In real life, I think he was in the mines by his teens. I do not know if he was an orphan or not. That was always the family rumor. And in the book, I chose to have him in the mines even earlier, as many of the labor leaders in Illinois, like John Lewis and Adolph Germer and others, were in the mines even as children. In the book, he is an orphan and rises slowly through the ranks, as he did in life, to eventually become this state senator and hold concurrently the post of sub-district president there on site during the time of the massacre. Yeah.
Now, he was actually not, that is, both the character William Sneed and your grandfather, they were not in Heron when this happened. Neither the character nor the real guy was in Heron when actually the events took place on that day.
That's correct. And, you know, this thing that I'm talking about with historical fiction and the after echoes comes into this. All I know for sure about the real-life man is that shortly before the massacre, he went to the Constitutional Convention for the state of Illinois in Springfield, and that's why he was out of town. Mm-hmm. Now, that's why I portray it that way in the novel. You know, because fiction is mostly about the feelings and thoughts of the individual characters and less about the, in my case, the sweeping historical forces. I wanted to try to get inside this guy that I was never able to actually know in life and try to figure out what that would have been like for him. How agonizing would the decision be to actually leave town at this particular time? As I wrote the novel, I found out some other historical things. The historian Paul Engel, who wrote a very famous book called Bloody Williamson, a nonfiction book, says that my grandfather knew about the contents of a meeting that was held a couple of days before the massacre at a mine building outside of Heron, and that he, quote, dodged the question about what happened there. And so, you know, as I look at the historical record, there was a bit of an indication that he might have known that the possibility existed for some of this to happen, but left town to do his other business anyway. So I try to use that to best effect in the novel.
But he also seems to be, he seems to be someone who was very conflicted about all of this, has this sense that what he says would carry great weight with the miners, and yet at the same time it seems that he never really feels that he is in control. And certainly I think once we're right on the edge of the massacre, he seems very clearly to feel that it's slipped beyond his control at all.
Yeah, in the book, you know, one of my main themes is the idea that we're all caught in systems, you know, and we can choose sometimes to join these systems of activities and unionism and so on. Oftentimes, these are not in our control. We are born in Southern Illinois, and the only thing being held out to us is coal mining or unionism or whatever it might be. The character of Sneed in the book is sort of aware of all of this, and he wonders, what is right action when you're caught up in a system of this fashion? You know, he takes a bit of a cosmic view at times. He wonders if there is violence, if maybe that won't serve unionism to the best in the end, talking about centuries worth of labor. Or, you know, more selfishly, if it will end his career or have, you know, effects for his townspeople. You know, part of the reason he's conflicted, of course, is not only this business about the unionism having visible effect in the area. You know, they were fighting for their very lives here. In the months and years before the Heron Massacre, there were so many other events that we can sort of chalk up to labor versus capital struggle, but start to look more like a class or culture war being fought in the United States at the start of the 20th century. And that class war finds vent in things like employment or labor, capital, race, ethnicity, and religion, and other things. And so in Illinois alone, in 1898, there were three fairly major events in which there were shootings on both sides. Oftentimes the mine owners trying to circumvent the union would bring in people, often African Americans from outside the region, and then there would be all this strife. The Colorado Coldfield War in 1914, where John D. Rockefeller had hired basically a private army and using the Colorado National Guard, you know, that incident ended when that army attacked a 200-tent colony at Ludlow, Colorado, that had 1,200 striking miners and their families in it. And there was machine gun and rifle fire and burning and looting by the militia that followed. 25 people died, including 11 children, 10 of the children and 2 women suffocated in a kind of death pit under a burning tent where they'd hidden for refuge. And just the year before the Heron massacre, there was something called the Battle of Blair Mountain, where 10 to 15,000 coal miners, and they were reacting generally to years of tension between capital and labor, but specifically to the murder of the mayor of Matawan, West Virginia. They fought a private army hired by the coal companies in what's been called the largest organized armed uprising in American labor history. And the U.S. Army sent bombers down from Maryland to disperse the miners with gas and explosive bombs. The stories that were coming out of West Virginia at the time included things like the Baldwin Felts men, these private security guards hired, supposedly kicked the fetus out of a pregnant woman who was a miner's wife and cut the breasts off of another and so on. And whether this was true or not, it was in the air. And supposedly one of the miners, possibly at that meeting in Heron that my grandfather knew about, said, "We've got to show the world that Heron ain't no West Virginia." A lot of conflict on anybody's part if they're living in the area.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Griswold. He's a lecturer of English at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He teaches undergraduate creative writing, both fiction and nonfiction. He is the author of the novel A Democracy of Ghosts. It's published by Wordcraft of Oregon, and it is about the Heron Massacre. It took place in 1922 in Heron in southern Illinois. He'll be doing an appearance and reading at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30 in the Author's Corner. So if you'd like to meet him, you can stop by. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, Champaign County, here where we are, line 1. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I was just looking through the Paul Engle book, and I'm glad you did the context, because that's kind of what I want to get at, how bloody the whole labor strife was through that whole period, not to justify anything that they did symbolically or otherwise. But it reproduces a picture of the wake of the miners killed in just the previous couple of days, and I'm just wondering whether you could tell us what the circumstances of that was.
And I'm glad you brought that up, caller. I have no desire to defend or condone the Heron Massacre. That's not what the book is about. I see the entire event as almost something of a kind of Greek tragedy in which the seeds of their own destruction were already planted in this kind of system that they were a part of at the time. William J. Lester had opened that mine southeast of Heron in September of 1921, and he hired union men to work it originally, shipped his first coal a couple of months later. And so when the strike came along, and he got the permission to remove the overburden and do repairs on his 2 big steam shovels like were used to dig the Panama Canal, he did that. But by early June, he had this big pile of temptation of profit in his yard worth about $3 million in today's money at a time when his competition across the country was stalled out and Lester said he was heavily in debt. So it set up this entire situation. When he fired the union men and started bringing in other workers to work on the steam shovels and the locomotive that was in the yard and to work the commissary and so on, that's when he brought in these private mine guards. The mine guards, they bullied and they cussed and they robbed of small change anyone who happened to pass the mine. They even pistol whipped a local resident. And McDowell was said to have said, "We came down here to work this mine, union or non-union. We'll work it with blood if necessary." Well, of course, it was a provocation, and the union men took him at his word. On the morning of the 21st, so this is the day before the massacre, a truck that was carrying more strikebreakers to Lester's mine was ambushed on its way from Carbondale, Illinois, about half an hour away, and 3 of the non-union men were injured. So when the shooting actually began the evening of the 21st, there had already been quite a lot of conflict, both verbal and physical. And that's when We don't know who fired the first shot, but certainly many, many rounds were fired. And one Union man was killed and two more fatally wounded right then and there.
So, Matawan, you mentioned, and that's the name of the film by a great filmmaker whose name is escaped.
John Sayles.
Right. And dramatizes that, but he doesn't dramatize the what you refer to as an aerial assault, which I'm a little surprised at that, but it was too complicated to explain the context. But Williamson, the bloody Williamson County, also goes into this gangster story, and I don't know how much time you spend on that in your novel, but it's intriguing too. And it includes, apparently, according to a friend of mine from Mount Vernon, an episode where one of the gangsters was actually attacking his opponent with a light plane, sort of a mob aerial. But I don't know that even that was even done in Chicago. So it was. I think, Dave, you had an earlier guest on who was talking about Illinois and the idea that they were playing down the idea how much it resembled the frontier image of the Wild West that we they were trying to portray it as being not here, further west. We're okay here. If that's clear. So thanks a lot. I'll hang around and listen.
And we have now mentioned a couple of times the Engel book, Paul Engel's book, Bloody Williamson. If people are interested in reading that, it is still in print and it's published by the University of Illinois Press. And it has account of the Heron Massacre, but some of these other things that we've talked about, but all happening in Williamson County. So if people want to read about that, they can seek out the book. And I think a lot of people think it's sort of the standard or definitive account of these events in Williamson County.
That's right. Yeah, Engel, who for years was the president of the Chicago Historical Society, got help from a Heron newspaperman and publisher named Hal W. Trevelyan, who had a small fine arts press, among other things. And Trevelyan informed Engel on many of these events, but wanted no credit in the book for fear of reprisal, actually. Mm-hmm. Just to speak to the caller's final comment there, the novel actually ends in the year after the massacre, and it ends just as the Ku Klux Klan is making its first appearance in the area. So much of the gangster business comes later after the context of the novel. Interestingly, Southern Illinois has always been very proud that we had the first aerial bombing in the United States.
Curious distinction.
Yeah, this is the kind of odd pride that is sometimes taken in that convoluted history. And it happened when the Shelton brothers hired a barnstormer in a biplane to take nitroglycerin and dynamite bombs over Charlie Berger's famous roadhouse named the Shady Rest. And they dropped them and they were ineffectual and didn't even go off. But that was often referred to as the first aerial bombing in the U.S. As it turns out, it was not, probably. It was instead this Battle of Blair Mountain.
Yeah. Our guest again, John Griswold. The book is A Democracy of Ghosts, and we're happy to have questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I know what you've tried to do in the book is you have tried to represent the perspectives of the various camps, in a sense, here, the perspective of someone like a grandfather who was an official with the Union. You try to represent the perspective of the miners. You try to and also represent the perspective of the people who were there in the mine, that is, the armed guys that were, and I know some of the kinds of words that people would use, the armed guards that were there to hired to protect the scabs that were brought in, the replacement workers, the non-union workers that were brought in. And one character in particular, you've created this character, James O'Rourke, who comes in and is one of these armed guards. And he seems in so many ways to be a very unlikely guy for this role. Early on, he's talking with one of the other armed guards. And that man, who interestingly enough is a local and seems very sympathetic to the miners, gives O'Rourke a pistol. He essentially says, this is your job. This is what you're going to have. You need this. And at his first opportunity, O'Rourke goes and hides it. So you think, what is this guy doing there? How did he end up there? What does he think's going on? And does that, what does that say about the people who are on that side of this conflict?
Yeah, O'Rourke is a kind of amalgam of various characters historically in this incident. And there was an interesting confusion in the historical record where there were actually a couple of O'Rourkes on the scene. One seems to clearly have been an armed guard. The other one was something else administrative and probably was not expected to help defend the mine, but of course when it came under attack was required to do so. I sort of use that confusion a bit built into the character of this Jim O'Rourke, who is hired as, you know, a scab accountant, basically, and then likes to think of himself as being up to the task of doing whatever is needed to protect his employer's business. You know, as I read the real-life history, certain characters stood out, and the O'Rourke combination, because sometimes it's hard to unravel the two of them, was very interesting. This guy was shot 6 or 8 times, humiliated, tortured, marched several miles, was tied by the neck to 5 other men. They were shot yet again, and when they fell, he pulled the rest down. Someone cut all their throats. They were shot yet again and urinated on and other things. The man survived and was later in the Heron Hospital talking to a reporter from the Brooklyn Eagle in a kind of boastful fashion. And I thought, how interesting is that, that he still has the juice left in him to be that way after all of this? And so that was sort of the birth of that character.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, thanks very much for the program. Recalling a lot of family history here, I just thought I'd pass along a little anecdote. I firmly believe my grandfather went to his grave never knowing whether he'd committed murder. He told the story about the mine wars down there in which he claimed to have been positioned on top of a hill and instructed by who I think was a union boss that if someone gets out of that car, shoot at them, and he closed his eyes and fired a rifle. And so your description of sort of this, this is the same man, of course, who I went fishing with and grew up around and grew to love as a grandfather. And it's your description of some of that family history really really touched me. So I wanted to call and thank you for your book. And hopefully I can get it here locally somewhere and give it a read. I'm real intrigued by what you've done. So thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you. I don't know. You can respond to that however you like.
Yeah, thank you. I think this is the one thing that writing the book has really taught me is that, you know, life is complicated and messy, and not that I didn't know that before, but as soon as you start trying to write about some of these historical characters, and I'm working on a nonfiction book about that town now for the History Press, which will probably be out by the end of the year, you know, it's hard to figure out who's the good guys and who the bad guys are. My young sons, when we settle into a movie at night, want me to tell them up front who's the bad guys. And sometimes it's just not that easy. The Southern Illinois writer Gary DeNeil, who wrote the definitive account of Charlie Berger, A Knight of Another Sort, got to know a character named Arlie Boswell, who was a state's attorney down there through much of this period, and clearly a vicious kind of a guy, and yet Gary describes him as entirely likable, even avuncular. So what are you going to do? You like them, you have contact with them, and then you watch your back, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that the caller story, your story, the story you hear, it does make me think, I know this is not very profound, but make me think about how people, when they're if they're part of a mob, will do things that if they were an individual, when they were on their own, they wouldn't do.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, even the leaders of the mob could probably be held to that. In the historical record, when you're reading about the men being marched away from the mine, and at some point the mob leadership changed, and a car pulled up, and the members of the mob are said to have said, oh, here's the president. And as I read this, even as a teenager, my heart kind of sank because I thought pretty sure they must be talking about my grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as it turns out, it wasn't the president. If anything, it was a man named Hugh Willis, who was a state board member for the UMWA and lived in Heron. And, you know, I don't know what kind of man he was. He was a participant in other things that came later, so maybe not so nice of a guy, but he's the one who actually gave the order, take these guys back out there and kill them. Kill all you can, he said. Would he have been that way if he wasn't reacting to the power of being recognized as someone who might be in charge of the mob? I don't know. It's an interesting question.
So was in the book, you deal with this and maybe some of your hesitance to place your grandfather at the scene or to implicate him by having his car stolen. Some guys come to the house, Will Sneed's house. He is not there. His wife is there. She faces him down with a gun. They eventually go away, but they take the car. And the car shows up later. And when some people see the car, they recognize the car as, you know, as an official vehicle or something belonging to an official. So this sort of word goes around that said, well, you know, somebody in authority said, take these guys out and shoot them. But don't do it here on the road. It's out in the open. No, take them out in the woods. So it seems like you're wanting to kind of let Will Sneed off the hook there by having the car stolen. So, and then you say he's packed off to Springfield in part, I think, because his wife says, get out of here. She recognizes what's going to happen. Everybody seems to know what's going to happen. And she sort of says to him, you know, you'd better not be here. You don't want to be here. So he has a good reason to be in Springfield, but he also has a good reason to leave. At the original event, was your grandfather's car there, or what? You know, what was the deal with the car?
Well, the car seemed to add to the confusion, and when they said the president, you know, I don't know whose car that was.
So but apparently, nobody knows anybody knows whose car it was.
Yeah, it's not recorded. You know, my grandfather had a Lincoln touring sedan or something, and it had these distinctive plates on it, and evidently it had some kind of an apparatus on the front, like a gold star or something, to indicate he was part of the Senate. Mm-hmm. So recognizable. And in the historical account, when the car pulls up and someone reacts to it and said, there's the president, I of course, use that as a kind of useful confusion in the fiction.
And if I remember right, that actually one of the survivors, this was an overheard comment. So this was kind of like secondhand or thirdhand. I mean, but someone said, oh, I overheard one of the armed miners say, oh, that's the president.
That's right. And, you know, in some respects, this is why I chose to have a first-person plural narrator in the book, a we, because there's a cacophony of voices in the historical record, and it's almost impossible at this point to straighten it out. It was almost impossible to straighten it out at the time, as all these proceedings showed. You couldn't get the truth. The we voice reports numerous things, some firsthand, some secondhand, and beyond.
About 10 minutes left. We're talking with John Griswold. He teaches creative writing here at the University of Illinois. His book, A Democracy of Ghosts, is a novel, and it's about the Heron Massacre of 1922. It's out now, published by Wordcraft of Oregon. I'm sure you can find it. I bet you can find it at the Illini Union Bookstore. You'll want to read it. He'll be there this afternoon doing a reading, by the way, at 4:30. Questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there are different communities here, in a sense, that you're trying to represent. There is an African-American community, and there are African-American characters. One particularly is a black woman who just happens to be the mistress of Will Sneed, who has a brother who is, I think, a deputy sheriff, interestingly enough. I guess it's an unpaid position, but nonetheless, that seems to be a little surprising that that would happen at this time. What is it you're wanting to get across with representing that community and what role they played?
Well, Heron has sometimes been referred to by the scholar James Lowen, for instance, who was just here on campus, as a sundown town. And certainly that was the rumor when I was growing up, that there was a law still on the books, which no one ever looked at. And even by the time I was growing up in Heron, there were African Americans living in town and so on. Lowen's account of it being a sundown town and many other places in the country are based on sort of scant evidence, and yet I don't exactly doubt him. The next town over was a place in real life called Culp, which was a largely African-American village. They worked a mine there, and later whites and others moved in. Jeremy Brown in the novel is a deputy sheriff of Culp. So it's a mostly black town to begin with. It is a volunteer position. Probably most positions in the town would have been. And there are roadhouses there at the time. So it's kind of a rough place. Pistol City, they sometimes called it. You know, what interested me is, as I said, when you read the historical accounts, certain experiences really stand out and give birth to some of these characters. The mob, when they marched the final six men in the massacre down to the Heron Cemetery, going, by the way, from the playground of the elementary school where I went to school, down a road called Stotler Street, past the house I grew up in, which was not there at the time, of course, in 1922. They took them out to the cemetery, and as they worked themselves up, they goaded on an African-American man, who was said to take part with frenzied participation. And as I quoted directly in the novel, one of the white mob members put his arm around Brown and said, "See, you know, we like you better than them, and they're white." And so there's a very kind of complicated psychology going on there, a clear segregation. And yet, given the right circumstances, a kind of evil participation.
Yeah, and it seems that these two characters, the woman and her brother, she particularly seems very acutely aware of just how limited their possibilities are where they are, and thinking a lot about if they could only get to someplace better, then they could be something better.
Yeah, I think, you know, she's a lot like William Sneed, the character in the novel. They both have high ambitions. They're both intelligent. They're both conscious people. And she's quite aware of her part in this entire time and place.
I guess I feel what you're, I know you're trying to capture, and what you need to do is to, when you're thinking about being in these people's place, I guess, or at least trying to get some feeling of the time, would be to try to understand how, for people who worked in the mine, how difficult life would be and how dangerous and what the ability to organize would have meant, and how you could see that could come down to being as far as a lot of people were concerned, a life and death kind of struggle.
Well, and just to interrupt you here, many of the comments by some of the mob members, both against the men that they were hurting at the time, and then later to the corpses that were on public display, were things like, "You'll never take bread out of my baby's mouth again." And, you know, it doesn't get too much more personal than that. This is what was at stake for these people.
And just to go back again to you sketched right at the beginning, sort of the basics, there were indeed trials. People were charged, but no one was found guilty. They were all found. They were all acquitted. All the people who were charged were all acquitted.
Everyone was acquitted. Bond was raised by the entire community. Someone said it was like taking the census when you looked at the names listed on the people who offered up money for bond. Absolutely no one was punished in any of this, and it was largely done through false alibis, and that too had its precedent in the county, especially going back to the Bloody Vendetta, in which for many years no one was ever punished seriously.
Yeah. There, you were talking about the fact that at the point before the massacre, there had been this armed standoff between the miners who were armed on the outside and the guards that were mined on the inside, and there were shots fired back and forth. And one of the things I, one of the questions I had down here was, does it matter to you who fired the first shot?
No. Historically, I think it matters. You know, I was talking with a friend about this the other day. He was questioning whether the Heron Massacre is the right term for it, that maybe it sounds a little too harsh or something. You know, going back to older definitions of massacre in times before we talked about sports teams massacring each other every day, massacre meant something very specific, which is the attack and killing, murdering of lesser armed opponents, often innocent or often completely unarmed. And there's no doubt that this is what it was. Once the men had surrendered inside the mine, you know, the mob took its pleasures on them and its revenge, and they were unarmed men. So, yeah, it doesn't matter to that degree historically who fired the first shot.
Yeah, and they were, when the men inside the mine surrendered, they thought they were going to be given safe conduct out of town, essentially.
This is what's said. You know, some of the accounts indicate that the people inside the mine thought, well, we're certainly going to die. We'll be overrun if we stay inside the mine. So let's take our chances and surrender.
Well, the book, again, the novel we're talking about here is A Democracy of Ghosts by our guest, John Griswold. It's published by Wordcraft of Oregon. John Griswold is a lecturer of English here at U of I, Urbana-Champaign. He teaches creative writing and will be making an appearance and doing a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon in the Author's Corner, 4:30 in the afternoon. So it'll be an opportunity to hear more from him, meet him. If you'd like to buy the book, you can do that. And I want to say thanks very much for giving me some of your time.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.